Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast. On Christmas Eve in 1945, the Sauter house was exactly what you'd expect a house with 10 kids to be on a night like that. Loud, warm, wrapping paper still on the floor, new toys already being fought over. A few of the younger ones trying to stretch bedtime like every kid in America suddenly becomes a lawyer on Christmas night. George and Jenny were downstairs. The older kids were settling in. The younger ones were still buzzing. Outside, it was cold, the way December is cold in the hills of West Virginia, but nothing unusual, nothing dramatic, just another winter night in Fayetteville, in a house that had seen plenty of them. And that matters more than it sounds like it does. Because this story gets strange later, real strange, but it doesn't start strange. It starts in the most normal place possible, a family at home, kids half asleep, parents thinking the day is finally over. The kind of night you forget 5 minutes after it happens because there's no reason not to. Then, sometime after midnight, the house caught fire. And from that point on, everything moves the way disaster moves. Too fast, smoke, shouting, people waking up all at once. A parent trying to count heads while the world is literally burning around them. The kind of chaos where nobody's thinking in straight lines anymore, because of course they're not. Some of the children made it out. Five did not. By morning, the house was gone. The fire had torn through it. The family was standing in the dark where the home had been, and five of the children were said to have died inside. But if that's true, why did the parents spend the rest of their lives refusing to believe it? And why did so many of the details that followed feel less like aftermath and more like interference? So before we get lost in what people think happened, let's go back to what actually did. If this is your first time here, welcome. If you've been here before, I appreciate you coming back. I'm Ralph, Marine Corps veteran, filmmaker, and the creator of Divergent Files. This series, Divergent Shadows, is the quieter side of what I do. Real stories told calmly and straight through. Enjoy, and let's begin. Inside the Sauter house, everything was close together. It had to be. 10 kids, 2 parents, a full life all packed into one place on a hillside in Fayetteville. There wasn't a whole lot of room for elegance. The bedrooms upstairs were shared, beds pushed in tight, a narrow staircase that probably announced you before you even hit the bottom step. The phone was downstairs near the kitchen. The coal stove stayed going through the winter because that's how houses warm during that time. Nothing unusual there, just a house built around function, not comfort. George Sauter had built a trucking business after coming over from Italy, and by 1945, he'd done well enough that people in town knew exactly who he was. He worked hard, had a temper when he needed one, and he was not shy about politics. That part matters too. He was openly anti-Mussolini, and he said it out loud in a part of the country where not everybody appreciated hearing it. Some people respected him for that. Some absolutely did not. Either way, he wasn't exactly a man who blended into the wallpaper. Jenny ran the house, which with 10 children is less homemaker and more full-time logistics operation with no weekends. Laundry, meals, school, noise, kids moving in every direction at once. The kind of house where silence would have felt suspicious. So when Christmas Eve rolled around, nothing about it would have looked strange to anybody standing outside. A few of the younger kids were allowed to stay up later than usual because, well, of course they were. New toys were scattered across the floor. Some of the older kids started drifting upstairs when they got tired. George and Jenny eventually turned in. And if you'd past that house around midnight, you wouldn't have stopped and stared. You wouldn't have seen some warning sign glowing in the window. You would have seen a family home after a long holiday night. That's all. But then something changed. And once it did, nothing in that house was simple anymore. Sometime after midnight, the phone rang. Jenny answered it downstairs. On the other end was a woman she didn't recognize, asking for someone who didn't live there. There was laughter in the background, glasses clinking, party noise, basically. Wrong number, strange time for it, sure, but not enough on its own to mean anything. She hung up and went back toward bed. And that probably would have been the last anyone thought about that call, except it wasn't. A little while later, Jenny woke up again. This time it wasn't the phone, it was the smell, smoke. At first, it seemed to be coming from George's office or one of the rooms near the phone lying downstairs. Then she saw the fire, and from there, everything starts moving the way these stories always move once they cross that line. Too fast. Faster than people think. One minute, you're trying to figure out what you're smelling, and the next, you're yelling names into smoke and heat and trying to understand which direction the fire is actually spreading. George and Jenny got out. Some of the children got out with them. In the middle of all that confusion with smoke filling the house and people trying to count heads in the dark, it became clear that not everyone had made it downstairs. Five of the children were still believed to be inside. And this is where the case stops being just a house fire and starts becoming something completely different. George tried to get back in. That part is consistent. He tried through the house, and when the flames made that impossible, he went for the ladder he usually kept against the side of the home so he could reach the upstairs windows. But it wasn't there. That ladder had a place. It was supposed to be there. In a moment where seconds actually matter, it was gone. So he did what a father in that situation does when the world stops making sense. He improvised. He ran to the two trucks he used for the business, planning to drive one close to the house, climb on top of it, and reach the windows that way. But neither truck started. And hold on a second, because that part is easy to hear too fast. These were trucks he used regularly. They had been working. This wasn't some rusted out junk pile sitting dead in a field for 6 months. He expected them to start, but they didn't. By then, the fire was moving too fast. The upper part of the house was becoming unreachable. The family was outside. The heat was building. The flames were taking over the structure. And the five children who were believed to still be inside were now cut off. Someone tried to call for help. And that's when they realized the phone line wasn't working. Later, they learned the line hadn't just failed. It had been cut. And that's odd. That's real odd. But in that moment, nobody standing out there in the yard had time to stand around and process how odd it actually was. They just knew the call wasn't going through, and the fire department in Fayetteville wasn't going to be coming quickly. Fayetteville's fire department was small and volunteer-run, and in 1945, that didn't mean engines rolling out in 90 seconds. It meant somebody had to raise the alarm, track people down, and get them moving. And it didn't. The local fire response was delayed for hours. By the time help finally arrived, the house had already burned down and collapsed in on itself. By sunrise, the family was standing where the house had been, looking at what was left with five of the children still unaccounted for. By morning, the fire was over. The house was gone. What had been a family home a few hours earlier was now a collapsed burn site, still smoking with neighbors, ash, and that awful kind of silence that shows up after something violent has already finished doing what it came to do. Local officials came in and started doing what officials do after a fire in a small town in 1945. They looked at the scene, they gathered what they could, they tried to determine how it started, what was left, and who had made it out. And pretty quickly, the shape of the official story began to form. The fire was treated as accidental. In early handling and later retellings, it was often described as electrical, tied to wiring or the Christmas lights. That became the working explanation, which was just a tragic house fire. Five children believed to have been trapped upstairs. A structure that burned hot, collapsed fast, and left little behind. That was the version the file started moving toward. And look, on the surface, that's not some outrageous leap. Houses do burn. Wood goes fast. Roofs come down. And in 1945, in a small Appalachian town, you weren't getting a modern forensic recovery team with floodlights and evidence grids and a dozen people in gloves crawling through every inch of debris. You were getting a local response in the middle of winter after a total structural collapse, and that detail matters. But even with all of that, this part never sat right with George Sauter. Because once the fire was out, the assumption came quickly that the five missing children had died inside and had been consumed by the blaze. Death certificates were issued. The loss was formalized on paper. On paper, the case was already starting to close, but George did not accept that. And this is where the story really changes shape, because he wasn't just refusing out of grief, or not just grief. Any father in that position is going to fight reality if reality is asking him to bury five of his children with no bodies. That's just human. But George also had a practical objection, and it was one he kept coming back to. He did not believe an ordinary house fire could completely erase five bodies. That became the center of it. He pointed to things in the debris that were still recognizable. Household items, appliances, bits of the structure. If parts of the home were still there in some form, he could not understand how there would be no clear remains from the children. Not bone, not anything he felt he could look at and say, yes, that proves it. That proves they were here. That proves they died here. And once that thought takes hold, it's hard to shake. Because then the comparison enters the story. George reportedly argued that cremation in a controlled setting takes intense, sustained heat over time. A crematorium is built for that. A house fire, even a bad one, is not the same thing. Now, to be fair, this is where people start fighting in the comment sections, and suddenly everybody becomes a fire scientist for 12 minutes. That's not what we're doing here. We're not trying to settle combustion physics from 80 years later. We're just staying with what the family believed and why they believed it. And George believed the fire did not explain the absence. That belief only hardened because the site itself became part of the problem. Accounts differ a little depending on which source you read, but the broad outline stays the same. The scene was disturbed not long after the fire. Debris was moved. The area was altered. In some versions, George himself had dirt pushed over the entire site later on, partly because the burned remains of the house were too painful to keep looking at, and partly because life, brutal as it is, keeps moving even when people don't want it to. But that also meant the place where answers might have been found was no longer stable. And once a fire scene gets disturbed like that, the record starts slipping fast. Later, bone fragments were reportedly recovered from the site. Now, that sounds important, and it is important, but it didn't settle anything the way you'd expect. Different accounts over the years describe those fragments differently. Some reports treated them as human. Other later accounts and retellings suggested they may not have belonged to the missing children at all. In some versions, they were said to be animal remains or unrelated material introduced later. So even the one thing that should have brought the whole story down to earth did not. The official file kept leaning in one direction. The five children were presumed to have died in the fire. That was the conclusion the town, the paperwork, and eventually the death certificates were built around. But inside the Sauter family, that never became settled fact. Because the fire explained destruction. It did not, in their minds, explain disappearance. And once that doubt took hold, every strange detail that came after had somewhere to land. Once the official version settled in, the story should have started getting quieter. That's usually how this goes. A fire happens, a ruling gets made, people grieve, the town moves on. The paperwork gets filed, and over time, the edges blur a little, but the shape of it stays the same. But this is not what happened here. Because once George and Jenny stopped being asked to accept what the fire was supposed to mean, they started looking harder at everything around it. And the more they looked, the less the night behaved like a clean accident. Let's start with the ladder. In the middle of the fire, George went for the ladder he normally kept by the house so he could reach the upstairs windows. But it wasn't there. That wasn't a vague memory. That wasn't him trying to reconstruct the night 20 years later. In that moment, while the house was burning, he went where the ladder should have been and it was gone. Later, it was reportedly found away from the house, down an embankment. And look, that doesn't prove some grand operation. It doesn't. But it does create a hard, ugly little question. If the ladder wasn't where it always was when the fire started, how did it end up somewhere else later? Did someone move it earlier? Did it get shifted in the chaos? Did George misremember where it had been? Maybe. Maybe not. The point is simpler than that. It was one more thing that did not line up cleanly. Then there was the phone line. During the fire, when someone tried to call for help, the line wasn't working. Later, it was discovered that it had been cut. Not burned through by the fire, cut. And years later, one of the stranger pieces of the case entered the record. A man reportedly came forward and claimed he had been the one who cut it. According to that account, he had been trying to steal what he thought was a power line and didn't realize he'd actually cut the phone line instead. Now, hold on. That is one of those details that sounds almost fake because it's so weirdly specific. A guy tries to sabotage one thing, hits the wrong line, and accidentally disables the family's ability to call for help on the exact night their house burns down? That doesn't mean it's fake or false. It just means it lands in the story with a thud. Even if you take it at face value, it explains one mechanical detail, but it does not explain the whole night. And then the witnesses start. This is where the case really starts refusing to stay in one box. Over time, multiple reports surfaced from people who believed they had seen some or all of the missing children after the fire. Not in some foggy internet forum way decades later, in local conversations, in statements, in recollections that became part of how the family understood what happened. One woman who operated a tourist stop between Fayetteville and Charleston reportedly said she saw the children the morning after the fire. According to later retellings, she believed they were with two women and two men in a car, and that the children looked frightened or under watch. Another woman who worked at a hotel claimed she had seen children matching their descriptions with adults, and that when she tried to speak to them, she got the sense she shouldn't. And this is where you have to stay disciplined, because witness accounts are messy. People remember wrong. People want to help. People insert themselves into stories. That happens all the time. But here's the problem. When a family is already convinced the official explanation failed, every report like that becomes oxygen. George didn't ignore those reports either. He chased them all. He followed leads. He asked questions. He traveled. He looked into claims that the children had been seen in other towns, in other states. Some of those leads went nowhere. Some just dissolved into rumor the way old stories do when nobody writes down enough at the time. But the important part is not whether each one was solid. The important part is that there were enough of them over enough time that the family never emotionally or intellectually came back to the fire as the final answer. And then there was the billboard. Years after the fire, George and Jenny put up a large roadside sign with the children's faces on it asking for information. That detail matters more than people realize. Because a billboard like that isn't just grief, it's defiance. It's a public refusal to let the town's version of the story become the only version. Every person who drove past it was being told, day after day, that this case was not over inside that family, not even close. The house was gone, the death certificates existed, the town had its explanation, but the Sodders did not. Years passed, not in the way people say it when they mean healing, just years passed. The kind where a family keeps living because life makes you, even when a part of the house is still burning in your head. The billboard stayed up. The questions stayed open. George and Jenny kept doing what families do when nobody can make them stop hoping. They listened to leads. They followed what they could. They lived in that awful space between official paperwork and personal certainty. Then, in 1967, something arrived in the mail. It was a photograph. The envelope was postmarked from Kentucky. Inside was an image of a young man, older now than the child the family had lost in 1945, but familiar in a way that hit like a punch. The face, the eyes, the shape of the features. To George and Jenny, it looked like one of their missing sons, grown up. And look, from the outside, people always get real brave around old family photos. They'll squint at a grainy image from 60 years ago and announce with complete confidence that it's obviously nothing. That's easy to do when it's not your child. When it is, every line in the face matters. What made the photograph worse was what came with it. There was writing on the back, strange, partial, not fully clear. Different sources quote it a little differently, but the version most often repeated reads something like this. Louise Sodder, I love brother Frankie, I lil boys, A90132 or 35. That is not a clean message. It doesn't explain itself. It doesn't tell a story. It just sits there like a fragment of something that either means everything or nothing at all, which is somehow the cruelest kind of evidence. Because what do you even do with that? If it's a hoax, it's a vicious one. If it's real, it means the official story was wrong by more than a little. The family didn't treat it like a prank. They leaned in. George, by some accounts, took the photograph seriously enough that he wanted it examined. Different versions of the story say he showed it to people he trusted. Some say he hired or consulted investigators over the years to chase leads connected to it. Some say there were efforts to compare the face, the age, and the features. The exact chain gets fuzzy depending on the source, and that matters, so we don't overstate it here. But what does stay consistent is simple. The photo did not get dismissed in that house. It got folded into the case. And once it did, everything changed again. Because before the photograph, the family was fighting a conclusion. After the photograph, they were holding on to a possibility, and that's a different kind of pain. A fire is one kind of grief, final, brutal, and physical. A maybe is worse. A maybe keeps breathing. A maybe lets you imagine birthdays that happened somewhere else, voices getting older, a child learning to shave, a laugh changing, a scar you'd still recognize 20 years later. It gives grief a second life, and then it makes you live with that too. That photograph became part of the family's internal truth, whether the outside world accepted it or not. It gave shape to the idea that at least one of the missing children had survived. And if one had survived, then the whole foundation under the official story started wobbling all over again. But even that didn't produce a clean breakthrough. no verified reunion, no confirmed identity, no final witness who could carry the whole thing over the line. Just a mailed image, a strange note, and a family staring at a face they believed they knew. And by that point, the case had fully split in two. There was the public version, and there was the version the Sodders lived inside. One said the children died in the fire. The other never stopped asking who took them. By the time this case had been sitting out in the world for a few years, it wasn't really one story anymore. It was a fire, sure. That part never changed. But after that, it split fast. There was the version the paperwork could live with. And then there was the version George and Jenny were still stuck inside. So when people talk about the theories in this case, I think that word almost makes it sound cleaner than it is. Like everybody sat down calmly and compared notes. But that's not what this is. This is a family refusing one answer, the town accepting another, and then decade after decade of people trying to patch the holes with whatever explanation seemed to cover the most ground. The first one is the official version. It's the one everything else pushes against. The children died in the fire. That's the baseline. The house burns, the roof comes down, five children are believed to still be upstairs, delayed fire response, small town investigation, death certificates, end of story. And look, on paper, that is not some insane conclusion. It isn't. Houses burn, fires collapse structures. Bad scenes get handled badly, especially in 1945. If you want the cleanest possible version, well, that's it. But let's hold on. The reason this case never stayed clean is because the family never believed the fire explained the absence. That's where the second explanation comes in, and really, it's less a new theory than a direct challenge to the first one. Maybe the children did die there, but the burn was misread. That was George's whole problem. Not that there wasn't a fire. Obviously, there was a fire. He watched his house disappear. His issue was simpler and somehow worse. He did not believe that kind of house fire should have left so little behind of his children. He looked at what was still recognizable in the wreckage and thought, wait, if those things are still here, where are the children? And that's not proof of anything by itself. It isn't. But it is the crack in the floor this whole case keeps stepping into. Then you get the explanation that gives all the weird mechanical details their sharpest edge. The children were taken before the fire fully trapped them, or during the fire itself. Now, we're in the part of the case where all the practical stuff starts leaning in one direction at once. The ladder missing, the phone line cut, the trucks failing when George tries to start them. The later witness reports. If you're somebody who thinks the children survived, that's the theory that pulls the most pieces under one roof. But wait, it has its own problem. It explains the oddities better than it explains the logistics. Five children is a lot. In smoke, in chaos, in the middle of a structure fire, with adults in and around the property, how does that happen cleanly enough that nobody leaves behind a trail that can actually be proven later? That's the part this theory never fully nails down. Then comes the motive question. If they were taken, well, why? This is where the case starts branching depending on who you ask. Some people frame it as retaliation. Personal, local, ugly. George had been openly critical of Mussolini, and according to long-running accounts, that did not make him popular with everybody. There are stories about arguments, stories about threats, stories about men around the property before the fire who, in hindsight, start looking a whole lot more important than they probably did at the time. Some versions keep it there. Others push it farther into organized crime, or some broader criminal pressure, or a coordinated act tied to those tensions. And look, that gives the story motive. It does. It gives it intent. It gives you a reason this family, this house, this night. What it never gives you is a clean name, a proven chain, or a solid piece of evidence you can slam on the table and say, there, that's who did it. Then the later evidence starts splitting too. Let's take the sightings, for example. Maybe some of those people really saw the missing children. Or maybe they saw children who looked enough like them in a story already hot enough that people started connecting things that weren't connected. That's not a lazy explanation. That's actually one of the more grounded ones. Memory is messy. Communities do talk. Faces blur. Once a story gets around, every kid with the right hair or the right profile suddenly becomes, I swear that was one of them. And that explains a lot. But, and this is where the family lived, enough of those reports felt real enough to keep chasing. And once you're in that state, every new lead is both hope and punishment. Same thing with the photograph. Maybe it was exactly what the family thought it was. Or maybe it was a hoax. That's one of the cruelest splits in the whole case. Because that image didn't arrive like some clean forensic clue. It arrived like a wound reopening in the mail. If it was fake, it was vicious. If it was real, then the official story had a body-sized hole in it. The hoax explanation makes sense. It absolutely does. People are strange like that, cruel little goblins sometimes. But even if you accept that, it doesn't change what the photo did inside that family. Then there's the explanation that almost never gets treated like a theory, even though it should. Maybe there was no master plot. Maybe the system just failed them. A delayed fire response, a weak recovery, a fast official conclusion, limited follow-up, no result that emotionally or physically settled the question. That by itself can create a mystery that lasts generations. You don't need a conspiracy if a tragedy gets handled in a way that leaves the family staring at a blank space. And honestly, that one carries real weight. But even there, let's hold on. It still doesn't make the stranger details go away. It just explains how those details had room to grow. And finally, there's the explanation outside observers usually reach for when they want to explain the family without calling them liars. The survival narrative became necessary. Not fake, necessary. That's the softer skeptic argument. Once the official answer failed to satisfy them, the mind did what the mind does under unbearable grief. It kept building a bridge toward survival because the alternative was ash, paperwork, and silence. That explains a lot emotionally, but it still doesn't settle the case. Explaining why a family needed hope is not the same thing as proving they were wrong to hold on to it. And that's the trap. Every explanation in this case feels like it grabs something real. The official story explains the fire. George's objection explains why the fire never felt like enough. The kidnapping theories explain the strange mechanics better than they explain the proof. The later sightings and the photo explain hope better than they explain certainty. The institutional failure angle explains how a mystery like this can survive. The grief angle explains why it never stopped breathing inside the family. And somehow, every single one of them solves part of the problem while leaving another part standing there in the dark. That's why this case never really closed. Not because there are no answers, but because every answer leaves an open door. The hardest part of this case is that it never really ended when the fire ended. That's the thing that really sticks with me. Not just the night itself, not just the missing ladder, or the cut phone line, or even the photograph that showed up years later like grief with a postage stamp on it. It's what came after. The life that had to keep going anyway. Because George and Jenny Sauter did not get what most people eventually get after a tragedy, even if it's awful. They never got a version of events they could live inside. The town had one. The paperwork had one. The death certificates had one. But they didn't. George kept looking. He kept following leads. Kept talking to people. Kept refusing the idea that the fire had settled the question just because the official file said it had. The billboard stayed up for years. That giant roadside sign with the children's faces on it became part of the family's life, which is a brutal sentence when you really stop and think about it. Imagine driving past your own unanswered grief over and over again because you still think maybe somebody out there knows something. And that's the word this case keeps choking on, maybe. Maybe they died in the fire. Maybe the remains were missed. But maybe somebody took them. Maybe that photograph was cruel nonsense. But then maybe it wasn't. That's not closure. That's a life sentence. George died in 1969, and by most accounts, he died still believing his children had not perished in that fire. He never accepted that the record had proven it. Not really. Not in the way a father would need to. Jenny lived much longer, and she kept the question alive after he was gone. The billboard stayed up for years after his death. She held on to the possibility longer than most people around her probably thought was reasonable, which, look, if you've never had to bury uncertainty instead of a body, I don't know that reasonable gets a vote. The surviving children grew up inside all of this, and that matters too, because for them, this wasn't just a mystery people talked about. It was their life, their house. It was their brothers and sisters. Their parents spending decades caught between grief and refusal. Every holiday after that had a shape to it. Every family gathering had missing seats in it. Whether anybody said it out loud or not, that kind of thing doesn't leave a family. It just changes rooms. And that, honestly, might be the most haunting part. Not the theories, not even the fire. It's the fact that this story kept asking the same question for so long that it outlived the people who first asked it. If you've ever waited for somebody to come home, you feel that a little differently. If you've ever stood in a doorway doing that quick count in your head, everybody here, everybody safe, you feel it differently. And if you've ever looked at an old family photograph and realized half the people in it are gone now and the picture is doing more work than it should, then this one lands where it lands. Because the Sauter case did not really leave you with a theory. It leaves you with a family that never got permission to stop looking. So all these years later, the same questions are still sitting there. Why were no identifiable remains ever conclusively documented in a way the family could accept? Why was the phone line cut? Why was the ladder not where it was supposed to be? Why did people report seeing the children afterward? And why did a photograph arrive years later that the family believed showed one of them grown up? The file treated them as gone. Their family did not. And if we're going to end this story honestly, then we should end it where the Sauters lived for the rest of their lives. Not with a theory, with the children who never came home. Maurice Sauter, Martha Sauter, Louise Sauter, Jenny Sauter, Betty Sauter. 5 children who were never conclusively recovered. And for their family, that question never really burned out. We've covered the story, and these are the shadows they leave behind. Thanks for being here tonight. If you want more stories like this, you know where to find me, you know where the links are. And if you choose to support the channel, it really helps. I'll see you next time.